You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Casey. I'll be joined shortly by co-host Dennis Wissman. Retirement today is totally different, as you know, if you're listening to this podcast. It can last longer, 20, 30 years even. And that requires a whole different type of planning and preparation, both financially and non-financially. We think lifelong learning is a part of that preparation. Longer lives, longer careers, and yes, longer retirements require a whole different approach to education and learning, and that's unfolding as the world of work continues to evolve. Our guest today is Dr. Michelle Weiss. She is the author of Lifelong Learning, Preparing for Jobs That Don't Even Exist Yet. Thinkers 50 named her as one of 30 management and leadership thinkers in the world to watch in 2021. She is a senior advisor at Imaginable Futures, and her work over the last decade is concentrated on preparing working-age adults for the jobs of today and the jobs of tomorrow. She was the chief innovation officer of Strata Education Network and Southern New Hampshire University. With Clayton Christensen, she co-authored the book Higher Education, Mastery, Modularization, and the Workforce Revolution in 2014, while leading the higher education practice at Christensen's Institute for Disruptive Innovation. Her commentaries on redesigning higher education and developing more innovative workforce and talent pipeline strategies have been featured in The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and Harvard Business Review, as well as on PBS NewsHour. Dr. Weiss is a former Fulbright scholar and a graduate of Harvard and Stanford. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us today.
So great to be with you guys.
I loved your book, Long Life Learning, and our listeners just heard your brief bio. But I was wondering if you could please share how you describe the story of your career so far.
Yeah, I don't think any of it made sense in the moment for me. It wasn't sort of a clear, straight, linear trajectory, but it all makes sense to me now in retrospect, kind of looking at the different kinds of transitions that I've made. I think the easiest way to sort of sum up my career is that I have inhabited almost every stakeholder position in the education and workforce ecosystem. So I've been a professor, I've worked for an ed tech startup, I have worked for a think tank, I have built an innovation lab for a mega online university. I've worked for multiple funders and have kind of thought deliberately about how we do more strategic investing in lifelong learning and the infrastructure needed for lifelong learning. And it's just kind of from there, it's been kind of an incredible journey. But when I look at all of the different kinds of encounters I've had over the years, it's all about job transitions. It's all about navigating job transitions and thinking about how adults do this more seamlessly over their lifespans. And so it started with working with service members, then it worked with kind of people in the sort of more underestimated populations, our bottom quartile of our population. And that's kind of been the sort of focus of a lot of my research and innovation efforts over the last decade or so.
What are the key trends that you see shaping the future of lifelong learning?
I think we know that we can't kind of think about the future of work as 5 or 10 years off from now. I think prior to the pandemic, there was a lot of discussion about job obsolescence and automation and roboticization kind of making jobs obsolete and the millions of jobs that we might see lost due to automation and computerization. I think the focus has really shifted from that future of work to the future of workers and how we navigate this more seamlessly and how do we start laying the infrastructure so that we can make these transitions more easily as we encounter more job changes because of all these different kinds of technological advancements we're facing in this very uncertain world of work.
I know you mentioned in your book, too, that there are some upsides that you see to automation.
There can be. I think we're in this really interesting moment where, you know, when we think about automation, we're actually at this interesting phase where Doron Acemoglu, who's an economist at MIT, would call it so-so automation. So we haven't actually created good enough technologies that can truly make work obsolete fully, so that then we can start creating new forms of creative labor that go alongside those that automated work. So what I mean by that is, as an example, when we think back to ATMs in the past, everyone thought that this ATMs would sort of make jobs completely obsolete for most in the banking industry. But it really only made obsolete a specific task, right? A specific set of tasks. And what it did is it generated a whole new set of services and customer service around lending and mortgage services and this kind of human touch that's needed for the banking industry. We haven't quite seen that happen over the last decade. You know, even though we see these incredible robots in Amazon warehouses, there's still this need for 600,000 warehouse workers and those folks who are picking and packing and putting the things into the boxes and sending them out from, they're kind of the interstitial tissue between the robots and us as the customers. So what we have is a lot of this kind of ghost work that's kind of this gray interstitial tissue that we haven't quite figured out how to make fully obsolete so we can move toward those more creative forms of labor. So that's kind of one thing to think about. So that's kind of sort of the downside. The upside is, as we move toward those more creative forms of labor, what it enables us to do is think about the ways in which we bring our human skills to bear. So, you know, I think there are just certain tasks that we have to relinquish to computers, to robots, because they will do them more flawlessly than we can as humans. But there's other work that machines simply cannot do. Or even if they did do it, we wouldn't want them to kind of give us terrible news about our health, as an example. We need that kind of human touch involved. So what are the things that we bring to bear in terms of our competitive advantage as humans? And that kind of human skills and the human labor, this isn't stuff that we've necessarily gotten to focus on as much over the last few centuries. It's been about kind of the more sort of industrial needs of the country. But this is just a really interesting way in which automation could potentially make us more human over time.
That's fascinating. With the 100-year life now in focus, how can people visualize what long life learning looks like over the life course versus, say, the more traditional model of education?
Yeah, so I should probably give a little bit of context to this idea of a 100-year life. There's actually some authors who have written about the 100-year life. It's the name of their book. And what they've shown us is that basically since the 1840s, every year we've added on an average of 3 months to our lifespans. And there's no sign that that's actually stopping or lessening over time. I think we do have an interesting phenomenon here with the pandemic that is kind of shaping our mortality rates, obviously, in this century, in this year, in this decade. But for the most part, we know that our lifespans have been extending. And then there are different kinds of futurists and experts on aging and longevity who are proposing that the first people to live to be 150 years old have already been born. So if we just take this concept of a 100-year life or a 150-year work life, even if we don't maybe fully buy into it or want to buy into it because we don't want to live 150 years, that's still a very helpful mental model for us to think about how do we actually thrive in this future where we are already seeing that a lot of working age adults are staying in the workforce for far longer than they had ever anticipated, well into their 60s and 70s. We see that early baby boomers are experiencing 12 job changes on average by the time they retire. So even if we just extend a little bit in terms of thinking about an extended work life, whether it's 60, 80, or 100 years, it's not actually that difficult for us to extrapolate and think, oh, we could possibly face maybe 20 or 30 job changes by the time we retire. And how in the world are we going to do that when navigating one is so, so difficult? And so the way that I think about a way to visualize this idea of long life learning is really the future of work and the future of education are going to become inextricably tied. So as we think about thriving in a world of work, we're going to have to make more continuous returns to learning. It's hard for us to imagine that even a 2-year degree or a 4-year degree can last us that 80 or 100-year work life. And so we need those continuous returns to learning to be much more seamless. If you kind of imagine a cloverleaf exchange on freeway or highway, right? And you're taking that loop off ramp, you're getting exactly the kind of skilling or reskilling or retooling that you need, and then seamlessly re-entering that highway, that workforce highway. It needs to feel like that. Right now, when we think about entertaining a job change, we don't know who to call, where to go, what learning pathway to trust. How do I know an employer will understand what this credential means? None of that is transparent and easily navigable today. So how do we envision a world in which long life learning becomes more seamless, like taking one of those cloverleaf overpasses?
Do you see changes in curriculum along the way here too? Do you envision that happening as people get into the secondary types of education?
For sure. I don't think the status quo will do. I think especially as we have seen the ways in which technology has changed how we think about content, right? And when we think about our historical roots in how we deliver education, it was more around content delivery and proliferation of kind of sharing that content versus the application of that knowledge. When we think about the problems we are facing today and will continue to face in the future, those problems are truly interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary. They don't have boundaries in terms of how we solve them. We are going to have to take tools and resources from one discipline or one domain and use it in new ways to solve the problems that we're confronting. We don't do a great job of that today as we think about our silos of education, our different kinds of academic departments that we teach our, that we construct courses in. We tend to sort of teach our learners how to solve problems in this particular discipline as a historical problem or an anthropological problem or a physics problem and a separate chemistry problem versus all of those things together at once, right? And when we are out in the real world, things are not given to us in these nice packaged silos and disciplinary structures. We have to figure out the kinds of tools we need to bring into play. So I think we're going to need to see more real world problem-based problem solving that's happening in our curricula, not only in our post-secondary systems, but also in our K-12 systems, because we're also seeing a lot of risk aversion on the part of our younger learners who are not necessarily willing to take on the debt load of college, and they need to see a way forward to go from maybe high school to a professional career to start making a living and maybe then kind of at the same time earning credentials. So we have to figure out how we cultivate the best problem solvers in the world.
Michelle, what do you see as the biggest barriers to lifelong learning and how can people work around them?
I think when people think about barriers to lifelong learning, we first immediately, of course, think about funding lifelong learning. And if you think about the way that we think about education and training today, a lot of the burden rests on the individual. Pretty much once you hit the age of 18, it's all up to us to figure out on our own how we navigate and remain competitive in the workforce. That has to change. And we already see that so much of our workforce really relies on government funding or employers to be doing more in terms of investing in their reskilling. There are a lot of different kinds of surveys that show that expectation on the part of employees is that their employers take care of them and their government does too. But of course, this isn't necessarily happening. Government resources are far more geared toward younger learners or people in full-time work. Same with our federal financial aid system. It's very much geared toward a younger learner. So we need to think about how do we relieve individuals and families of the burden to reskill and upskill so that not all of the risk is on them. And so you see different models occurring around lifelong learning accounts, and this is happening around the world, but we need to do far more in terms of thinking about how we make this more doable for anyone who is seeking to gain new skills. But I think even more important than the concept of funding lifelong learning, which is huge, is, or probably at least co-equal to this challenge, is the challenge of time or time poverty. I think the pandemic has illustrated it perfectly in terms of all the different kinds of activities working adults and working learners are juggling behind the scenes, right? Hidden from view. These are things that we have always been doing in terms of caregiving responsibilities or work responsibilities. There's so much life that gets in the way, and it's really difficult to figure out how to carve out time to develop new skills. And that onus, again, cannot be on the individual to just sort of figure out how to add that in on top of all the other sorts of responsibilities and things they have to do day to day. So how are employers maybe going to carve out time in the workday so that learners can build new skills? This is sort of really critical as we think about the main barriers we see. I think in my book, what I try to do very specifically is not just sort of say these are the problems, but really all of these challenges that I'm just surfacing right now come from the learners themselves. They come from these qualitative interviews we've done with people who are not thriving in the labor market. And this is one of the biggest things, like as so many of these learners talk about this kind of hustle that they feel in order to survive, how is it that they can deal with this challenge of time poverty, that they don't necessarily have time off to just develop new skills for the future of work?
It's funny. I see an irony here. Technology has been a blessing and a curse in ways. It leads to more productivity at work. I know in my occupation, it was a clear example of that. But in home life, personal life, you know, people are so absorbed with their phones and their tablets. And you wonder whether or not they can take some of that and spend more of the time focused on other things. How do you best use it? How do you best live with it, I should say, maybe?
Yeah, there's another strange irony, which is that a lot of employers are, as they see the ways in which automation and technology is reshaping work, they can see the ways in which the need for human skills is really important for the work ahead. So when you even just look at the millions upon millions of job postings out there, there's this huge increase in the demand for human skills around communication and presentation and collaboration and systems thinking and critical thinking. And the initial sort of instinct reaction might be, oh, that's great, right? Because we as humans bring uniquely human skills to the table. And that's true, except I think what people forget is that those uniquely human skills require deep practice. Even though they're innate within us, they're not sophisticated within us. We are not necessarily great at these human skills. They require a different level of practice and engagement. And so, like, even if we watch a one-hour course on LinkedIn Learning about empathy, we're not suddenly going to be very emotionally intelligent, right? So how do we practice these skills for the future? We haven't quite figured out how we do that, especially for more mature learners. We think we have all these skills, but if we think about the different kinds of frictions that exist in the workplace, this is something that we really need to work on. And even simple things like giving feedback or receiving feedback, these kinds of human skills, we need ways to practice these skills every single day so that we can then better complement the work of machines or coordinate better with the work of machines.
Yeah, well said. Best I've ever heard that stated. Thank you for that.
Such a great point. And as an executive coach, I work with a lot of brilliant people on furthering their development of those human skills. And I appreciate your point on the deep practice it takes. And it's not just knowledge and learning the skills, it's really getting better at them over time. So appreciate that point. Can't emphasize that enough.
Yeah, I think we sometimes think it's like the problem we need to solve versus trying to navigate what can often be those messy interactions between humans. How do we facilitate those and how do we better engage? And especially as we encounter more and more change, you see companies dealing with the challenge of change management or innovation management, right? Because there's a lot of fatigue around how do we adapt to all these different changes? And part of that is how do we build that resilience within our working learners?
Makes a huge difference, absolutely. So I'm still reeling a little bit from hearing you say today the 12 jobs people have over lifespan. I found it to be an eye-popping number when I came across it in your book, even though I know the trend. And then you extended it further, thinking about the 100, 150-year life. So how can people upskill and reskill as this future of work continues to evolve?
Yeah, first, it's just a mindset shift, right? To open our minds to the fact that education is simply not going to be a one and done experience that we leave behind at the front end of our careers. I think that's the way we used to think about things, right? It was sort of this learn, earn, rest model. And that's just not going to hold for the future. The other thing as we think about building infrastructure and architecting this future is that we really need to think about how we knit together different sorts of solutions and services in our regions, in our states, in our local counties, of knitting together resources, for instance, that offer better career navigation, that offer real kind of wraparound support services for our learners who have a lot of life that gets in the way. We need more precise educational pathways. We need those pathways to be more integrated with the ways in which we earn a living, right? Earning this kind of integrated earning and learning or hands-on learning in the flow of work. And we also need different kinds of skills-based, more transparent hiring practices. So these five principles that I just kind of quickly run over are these principles that need to be true in order for us to build a better functioning learning ecosystem for the future of work. So we need, and this doesn't mean that we kind of have to start from scratch, because even as we think about this from a very local level or a city level, we know there are all kinds of different resources and innovators and innovations that exist that do some of this work, but they're just not comprehensible or transparent or navigable for any layperson that you kind of take off, you pull off from the sidewalk and ask them how are they going to navigate their next job change. They don't know necessarily about all of these different resources. So how do we make this more navigable so that when someone is facing that next job change, they know exactly where to go. They know who to reach out to for that kind of trusted guidance and advice and better career navigation. They know that these sets of competencies or this credential or this certificate that they're about to embark on is going to be worth it because this employer over there hires based on that. We need all of this to just be more understandable for anyone, any job seeker who is looking to make a job change.
You mentioned employers before, and I'm curious, how can companies help their workforce upskill and reskill?
The main thing that companies can do is to start building their existing or their incumbent workforce. For far too many years, I think it's been now four decades in the making, we have really moved towards this buy, not build mentality. We'd much prefer to recruit externally for talent as opposed to really understanding the skills of our existing workforce and trying to fill the gaps that they may have for the work that we foresee that we need to achieve in the future. We even prefer to hire objects like computers and robots instead of dealing kind of with organizational change and redesign. And so that really has to shift. But what that means is it can't just be the dangling of tuition reimbursement or tuition assistance dollars. We often, if any of us have been employed in a company, there are often these different kinds of benefits that exist as a human resources benefit. And we can maybe access up to $5,000 at a time a year to gain new skills by going to this one an accredited institution out of an array of possibilities. But again, the implicit assumption there is that the worker is going to do this on their own time. We haven't figured out a way to carve out time when we think about on-the-job training. the amount of hours that we devote to on-the-job training over those last four decades has just dwindled down to nearly nothing, to the point where 44% of employers don't offer any sort of reskilling opportunity, any sort of opportunity to build new skills for emerging roles. And that's a huge problem. That's just not sustainable. So how do we think about kind of reimagining on-the-job training so that it's not always about compliance training or risk mitigation or getting folks to take that sexual harassment training, which is critical, but we need to figure out how do we also build out more time in the flow of work so that people are building new skills for those jobs that we can see ahead?
Sounds like a sabbatical, a purposed sabbatical.
Yeah. And the most forward thinking companies in this space are building in that breathing time. You know, maybe it's just an hour a week or an hour a day, but it's critical as we think about the long-term competitiveness of companies. They really do need to start making those investments now and consistently for their employees.
One thing you mentioned earlier was on-ramps and off-ramps. What's the current state on that, and how can institutions advance this idea?
So currently, we just don't have a lot of on and off ramps when we think about this sort of continuum of work, right? If we think about a 50-year work life or an 80-year work life or a 100-year work life, right? There aren't these little off ramps we can take just to kind of acquire just what we need and then come back on to that workforce highway. And so that's, again, where we think about a better functioning ecosystem. We need our different systems to start speaking with one another in more collaborative ways. So right now, everything is kind of siloed. The activity that K-12 does is quite separate from the activities of higher education, which are separate from our different kinds of workforce training opportunities, which are separate from what our employers are doing. And they all speak different languages as they talk about skills development or competencies or learning objectives. They all have different ways of talking about the same sorts of skills. So what we've had over time is this kind of giant Tower of Babel, where maybe these 600 universities and these 50 employers are actually talking about the same things, but we've generated thousands of competencies, meaning those same kind of core baseline competencies that we're talking about, you know, those kinds of human skills as an example. So part of the sort of first step in moving toward building more on and off ramps is that we just need to start building this kind of foundational layer of a better data infrastructure, better taxonomies and ontologies around skills so that we know what means what when we're asking for these particular skills in a job description. And there are lots of incredible initiatives that have been building over the last decade, many of them facilitated, for instance, by the Chamber of Commerce Foundation, where we're trying to start to build these common taxonomies or learning and employment records so we can start just doing things more efficiently. So there's that one kind of somewhat unsexy piece of just kind of a data infrastructure that we need to build these on and off ramps. But we also need to start giving credit to these alternative learning pathways that have emerged over time to help people move to better opportunity. So there's all these different kinds of things that I talk about in my book that I call on ramps that are dealing with that kind of human skills building plus the technical skills building in things like advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, healthcare, data science. And they're taking people, even people who used to be formerly incarcerated, and they're moving them into much better opportunities through these immersive short burst training opportunities that give them those human and technical skills. So those are the sorts of on-ramps that we really need to see more of in the future so that people can get just what they need in order to move to a better place where they're not always feeling that kind of hustle to survive.
Michelle, what do you think the longer impact of the pandemic will be on lifelong learning?
I think one pretty incredible just sort of near-term impact, which I think will have long-term ramifications for us, is because of the COVID pandemic, if we just sort of think about the years prior to the pandemic, a lot of people who were working in education and workforce strategies could identify that we were already leaving behind a huge portion of our population, close to 41 million Americans with only a high school degree who were not earning a living wage. So we knew there were people who were not doing well in the labor market. But the question was, how do we bring that kind of sense of urgency to making sure that we don't make that population larger and that we bring people along and move them into that kind of more economically mobile situation? The good thing about the pandemic, even though it was so painful to see, is that we saw how incredibly stuck our different systems were in terms of trying to help millions of workers transition into open opportunities. When our retail and hospitality and restaurant, kind of those sorts of domains, were just completely decimated by the pandemic, we had millions of workers who were laid off, furloughed, who had no way of transferring their skills into adjacent domains. We know there are transferable skills that people have, but we had no mechanism, no ability to kind of fluidly take people and move them into these jobs that actually were in demand. So I think even though it was deeply tragic to see this kind of incredible stuckness, what is key is that it made clear that we cannot continue in this manner. All of these different kinds of siloed activities of these different systems won't suffice. It just doesn't work. It's not the infrastructure that we need for the future. So how do we, instead of thinking about these siloed systems, think about greater interdependence and greater integration so that we can get clear on those transferable skills, on those workforce readiness skills, to say, even if you were over here in hospitality as a customer service representative, you could move just as easily into this opportunity in human resources or financial services or advertising, marketing, and PR. We actually have data that shows these different kinds of transitions that are possible, but how do we now make that much more the norm instead of just kind of these idiosyncratic pathways that a few people have been able to manage? How do we instead make it so that millions of Americans can understand that with these skills, I can actually move into a much better pathway?
Some of our listeners are interested in creating second careers or encore careers after their primary career comes to an end. What advice would you offer them on how lifelong learning can help them?
So I think one piece, if we just sort of return to that idea of human skills, is our more mature workforce and our more mature working learners have developed and honed a lot of those human skills over time. So how do we share those insights through mentorship opportunities with younger learners in particular? How do we think about building new kinds of learning experiences where people can kind of begin to practice those skills? I think that's kind of one critical piece to think about. I think the concept of sort of pairing more mature learners and workers with younger workers is something that we're seeing kind of more uptake on within the workforce. And it's interesting too, because I think there's a real opportunity to sort of debunk the idea that somehow a more mature learner or worker is less savvy in terms of tech skills. I think what we've seen through the data, as an example, is just that across all of our different sorts of age groups, there is just sort of a lack of digital skills literacy. I think we tend to make this strange conflation, or we think that younger learners are just more digitally savvy, but they're not actually. When we look at the data, they actually lack digital skills in great numbers, in surprising numbers. They may be great at sort of social media literacy, but they may not actually be able to engage in the sorts of SaaS software or different sorts of project management tools or simple digital literacy tools that we use every day in the workforce. And so I think there's this opportunity to kind of debunk this myth that somehow, because we're dealing with a more mature worker, that they're going to be less apt to develop their tech skills. I think we're going to see over time some different kinds of flexible work arrangements that emerge, because we're going to actually need to leverage the expertise of our part of our workforce that normally would have retired. But there are actually ways of keeping that institutional knowledge and also really accessing that real deep expertise in an area through flexible work arrangements because maybe that more mature learner doesn't actually want to engage full-time in the workforce. And then finally, I would just sort of say one key piece of, as we think about this kind of future of education and future of work, is that all of us are going to have to learn, not only learn new skills and broaden our human skills, but we're also going to have to unlearn some of our bad habits over time. Some of the kinds of things that we've developed as our workforce competencies are not necessarily the things we want to hold tight to. So we need to also kind of open our minds to potentially letting go of some of the ways we've kind of developed our skills over time in order to build new skills for the future.
That's such a great point. Thanks for making that. And Michelle, you've been generous with your time. I was wondering if we could ask you one more question. So you mentioned mentoring, and you're in a position to mentor people at the stage of your career and going forward. I'm curious, who has had impact on your career and development as a mentor?
I am so lucky to have had many different mentors at different phases of my career, but probably one of the most impactful mentors for me was Clayton Christensen. I had the great privilege of getting to work with Clayton Christensen, who created these theories of disruptive innovation or disruption that so many people talk about. He was a generous and kind teacher, and I got to write a book with him, write different sorts of articles with him. And his theories were really helpful in terms of just helping me develop a worldview in which I could think about the future with less fear and anxiety and hesitation, and instead kind of more of that kind of positive stance. Because even the things that we might sort of want to view as a threat or see newness as some sort of danger, it actually, all of his theories gave me these different kinds of tools to analyze these things that were emerging on the horizon and trying to look at them as openly as possible to think, is this thing actually good enough to improve over time to potentially disrupt an industry? And just so many incredible lessons I've learned from him over time that I find myself just sort of reflecting on every single day. And not only that, he was an amazing storyteller. And so part of the hard lesson and the great lesson I've learned over time is that data is important up to a point, but the most important thing you can do with data or an insight is to build a story around it and think about storytelling and how you really sort of capture the heart of your audience. And that is something that I'm still learning over time, but he was kind of a master at.
Everything I've read about him, special person as well. I often recommend his book, How We Measure Your Life, people, very useful. Michelle, thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with us. It's a great book, and we'll continue to follow your work and the impact you're having on lifelong learning and education.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle. So a very interesting podcast today with our guest, Michelle Weiss. We appreciate her joining us today. Joe, what were your takeaways from today?
So it was a great conversation. I'd love the opportunity to talk with her after reading her book. Very thought-provoking. There's a combination of big picture takeaways and more micro-level individual takeaways that I came away with. And I'll highlight three, although I could probably highlight easily about 20. First one is her point about the mind shift that's required. And that's both for individuals and also for companies and institutions in terms of this new long life that we had the opportunity to talk with Andrew Scott about. And I think it really does take a new mindset to think of careers, think of learning, think of balance, and a lot of other things as well. And the second thing, she highlighted human skills from a learning standpoint, different ways in which people can continue to advance them. And I loved her point on it takes deep practice. These are not skills that necessarily shallow knowledge and practice will help, but you really have to hone them. She also made the point that more mature workers tend to have honed them on their own, have a lot of experience there, and they can be leveraged in a competitive marketplace in different ways, starting with mentoring in other ways, but I think that could give people an advantage. And then third, I was struck by her point on digital literacy, and she didn't use the word ageism, but I think the ageist stereotypes that people may have about, well, those of us who are older may not be as tech savvy, and the younger people are more tech savvy. She cited data that says it's actually not the case. People, younger people may be more tech savvy in social media and things like that, but maybe not as much as more mature workers in the professional skill set arena. How about you, Des?
I'll pick up on a little bit on the mindset shift. As an individual who's getting older and they're thinking about traditionally and literally, perhaps, we think about our careers and we think about our skills and we think about what we're good at and we think about what we like. But I think it's real important that we ask ourselves when we're examining the shift we want to make or the other or another opportunity that we're looking at is to think about what things do we have to learn? And sometimes we pause when we hear that question. We might pause when we hear that question, I should say. But most importantly, you have to really do your homework and be intentional about there are things that you might want to pick up and need to learn to help you do better in the next thing. So it opens your mind up to that lifelong learning. In conjunction with that, she also mentioned there are habits that you have to unlearn. So finding out the things that you need to let go of from your past a little bit in order to move yourself forward, perspectives you may have, they all tie into that open mindset. And I think those can be very helpful and very applicable to the older worker. And right at the top, it's a great theme. She said that the future of lifelong learning, there's a shift going on from work to workers and the impact that technology is having. And that's a constant theme that I encourage people to learn as much as they can about this. There are obviously Michelle's book is great. Open your minds up to continuous learning and bringing on new skills for yourself. I think those are the points that I would take away. And today was great.
Well, thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. Retirement's a major life change, and it can be hard to know exactly what to do next. But you've worked hard for your entire career. Now that you'll have the time and freedom, you probably don't want to wing it. You've probably been a planner, and you need a plan for how you're going to invest your time. Our coaching can help you design a new vision of your future and ways to make it happen. We'll work with you to define success on your own terms so that you can retire smarter.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.